The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network
on News Talk.
I was handling live bombs, but shelf packers were paid more than me. So says a former Army Bomb Squad member who faced many life or death situations over 10 years, but left the Defence Forces when he realised he was undervalued and certainly underpaid and forced to claim family income supplement to support his wife and family. Mark Healy, good morning.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Now, tell us about your army career, first of all. How old were you when you joined, and when did you get into bomb disposal?
Well, I joined on the 27th of April, 1998, at 17 years of age, back in the day when you could join with a letter from your parents to say you could do so. I spent 9 years in 6th Infantry Battalion, which is in Custine Barracks, Athlone. And soon after that, then I decided I wanted to trade. I liked the weapon systems. I liked how they worked. And so I decided I'd have the Army do something for me, I suppose. And I went into the Ordnance Corps. I spent 4.5 years trained to be an armourer. And then after that, then I stayed in Ordnance. I stayed in the Corps. I liked it so much over in the Corps. So I spent the next half of my career over in the Defence Force Training Centre in the Corps camp.
Now, the kind of skills that you learnt, you know, you wonder whether bomb disposal skills can be deployed in civilian life. We'll come to that in a little while. But obviously, you learnt a lot on that training course.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the natural progression after an armourer's course is to go on and be an artificer. That's the other half of the weapon systems. But I suppose a natural route as well on top of that would be explosive ordnance disposal. So when you hear on radio or television, bomb squad, that's explosive ordnance disposal in technical parlance. But in terms of the qualification to become an EOD operator, it was the civilian equivalent of that was a mechanical automation maintenance fitter, or fitter armor, as it was called in the Defence Force, mm-hmm. The official title. So you're talking about really an apprenticeship. It's called a trainee technician scheme in the Defence Forces when people are picked from the ranks to go and do this. But you have to display an aptitude with your own abilities, academic abilities, and then again your abilities, I suppose, in terms of what you can do with your hands to be a machinist. In other words, with milling, turning, welding, bench fitting and fabrication. You have to be able to have that aptitude for it. And then once you've qualified with that, then you can progress on into explosive ordnance disposal, where that sort of knowledge of machinery and mechanisms is completely applicable to explosive ordnance disposal in terms of mechanisms of action of different devices.
Now, did you ever go overseas and apply your trade there?
I was overseas 4 times. The one time I was overseas was in 2016, was with ordnance. We were building up to an EOD-capable mission then, so it was within my remit and my team's remit. There was only 4 of us overseas on that trip to make sure that the upcoming mission, who was taking over in an EOD capacity, had all the tools of the trade, all the robots, the machinery, the, mm-hmm. the X-ray machines, the developing stuff and all that. But, yeah, it was the sort of thing that we did encounter overseas, and I have encountered overseas. Even for my first trip in 1999, I did encounter IEDs, which are extremely and infinitely more dangerous, I would say, than a conventional munition. And you can see into the mind's eye of someone who has made this through their experience. And it's scary when you see what someone else's mind is capable of, and how you can apply your own mind to try and deal with someone else's mind in terms of their imagination, how these things are put together. And it's quite different,
so
I suppose,
classic situation where you recognise a piece of ordnance and it may still be potentially explosive and you have to dismantle it knowing what you know about how it's been constructed. But these improvised explosive devices, we heard a lot about them in Iraq, yeah, when the Allied forces were in there, and they were potentially extremely lethal.
They were the greatest threat to any coalition forces in the entire war. And it's not only the lethal effect, but it's the psychological effect. You can have a conventional munition path where you can go into Google and you could study the mechanism and how it works. Or what you could do is you could look at an IED, which is improvised, and you're dealing with, as I've said, someone else's imagination. And that is where you can't Google it. You can't look up. You can only use your previous experience with these things, where like, as I'm saying, you can study in academically in the books, or you can, what you can do is you can use experience in dealing with these things to gain your own knowledge about how these things are manufactured and made, and someone else's mindset into them. And that's what makes them infinitely more dangerous than a conventional munition, because in conventional munition, as I said, you're dealing with something that has been manufactured by a company, but an improvised device, you're dealing with someone else's imagination. And different folks, different strokes, and I've never seen two the same.
And the point about it is that they may not use, if you like, even in areas, theatres of war, where there's lots of munitions lying around, they may use other materials. You know, famously in Ireland, fertilizer was used. They could use any sort of material that is combustible and can be made to explode.
There's plenty of avenues out there. I'm not going to talk about them on national radio,
sure,
but there's plenty of avenues out there. And as I've often said, you know, this information can be got. Of course, it's completely illegal, but I don't think people who are making these things are worried about laws. In terms of EOD call-outs, there was a couple of years there where EOD calls, there was nearly one, two a week. And, you know, it's not the sort of thing that the Defence Forces would, you know, shout from the rooftops and fanfare because of the consequences then with the public becoming very agitated and very, I suppose, maybe worried about these sort of things. But it does go on, it does happen. I'm sure there's plenty of listeners out there who could come up with their own stories about how they saw the EOD truck pull up with the guards and the perimeter set up and all. It does happen, and it happens more than you would think. But this is why I'm here on the show, Pat. It's an absolute disgrace that the Defence Forces is being treated the way it is because of a consecutive government just not caring. You can't do what has been done to the Defence Forces without it being by design. Otherwise, you are monumentally inept. You know, that's my point about consecutive governments and how the Defence Forces has been treated. It has to be an agenda there. It has to be. I know there's conversations going on. There has to be conversations going on about how more to, I don't know, eviscerate the Defence Forces. They have no voice, they can't speak, can't complain, but yet they'll never let down the Irish people. They'll make it a point, even throughout all of this. They'll not even endure so much, but they won't let down the Irish people.
Now, and you obviously enjoyed the challenge of your job, and it's baffling to the rest of us why you'd put your life on the line, because what you're doing is extremely hazardous. But you clearly enjoyed it, or you wouldn't have stuck it for so long. What brought about, you know, the realization, hang on a second, why am I doing this? I'm not appreciated for what I do.
Well, like so many who have left before me, Pat, just to clarify something that was written in the paper, I'm a father of two kids, but I was a father to two kids as well. So I had four kids to look out for as well as my wife.
Yeah.
And even though I love the job, absolutely love the job, it was a vocation for me ever since I was a child in a buggy. I had a little cap gun or whatever. I never wanted to be anything else. So it was a vocation for me and I loved it. But there's only so far I can go with doing what I love to the detriment of my family and then possibly depriving my kids, the four of them that were there, of a father and my wife of a husband, because I love doing what I'm doing. And then them suffering the whole time, because it's, in terms of service to the state and service to my family, it wasn't about me, it was about them. And as time went on and the four children at home, I couldn't keep saying no to them. I couldn't, and then keep disappearing for 24 hours at a time and coming home with 36 euros for 24 hours work after tax. That's what I was getting paid on top of my wages, 36 euros after tax. And what the defining moment for me was when I said, holding a device in my hand, I just looked at it and I said, this thing could end me in a second. And I just looked at the other number two, who's also a driver, and I just said, I've had enough. I can't believe I've gone this far and believing this much about what I'm doing in EOD. And here we are at the end of the day, and I'm getting paid 36 euros for it, 36 euros. And I can't believe that I'm doing this for this much. And I'm thinking about my kids, and I'm thinking about what could happen if they were deprived of a father and my wife was deprived of a husband. I can't justify it. And I think it's ridiculous that this has gone on so long. And I don't know, it just bewilders the mind as to where people's mindsets are in terms of looking after the Defence Force when this is going on every day. And then I hear Simon Coveney, he's talking about bringing on 3,000 more troops and this is going to bring numbers up. All sounds great on paper, and to all the ears out there who don't understand the mechanisms in action with the Defence Forces. And I'm just thinking to myself, if you looked after the Defence Forces 20 years ago, you wouldn't be looking for 3,000 troops now. You would have highly skilled, experienced operators of all levels, from all the way from the ground up, and you wouldn't be looking for it. But now we have, it's like the purges, the great brain drain, where everyone there with a qualification is gone. You've got members of the ARW there. Some individuals of the ARW, and I'd ask any of your listeners out there who would tolerate this, they're owed up to €40,000, which has been signed and sealed by the state, still to get it. Now, who in their right mind would wait more than a month for 40,000? And you've got operators in a tier one unit. These guys are the heavies. My God, Pat, you've no idea. We think about Navy SEALs now. These guys, Navy SEALs haven't got a patch in these guys. And they're owed up to €40,000. And they are still there, still wearing the flag, one foot in front of the other, soldiering on. And this is more of it.
Mark, tell me, at what point does it become not fit for purpose? You know, the way we look at the health service and say we have a shortage of neurologists, a shortage of A&E consultants, a shortage of this, a shortage of nurses. We couldn't manage without doctors and nurses coming in from overseas, trained elsewhere, not even in Europe, to service our hospitals. At what point does the army become critically short of people so that it's no longer fit for purpose?
It becomes unfit for service when you've got people making decisions who have plenty of academics and haven't got the hands to bless themselves. That's where it becomes unfit for service, when they write things down on paper, and because they write it down, then it is so, instead of actually putting real, positive, true, meaningful action into place. And actions will always speak louder than words. Men can't spend, and women of the Defence Forces can't spend, placations and hollow gestures and oh, we will. But it's never happened. How many commissions in the Defence Forces, into the Defence Force have we had now? Talks upon examinations of the Defence Forces, and we're going to have a commission into this, and we're going to have a talk about the commission, about the paperwork that was... It's going on and on, kick down the road. And I'm just waiting, Pat, for the strategic little kick back now. There'll be some scandal in the Defence Force released now, because I'm kicking this up to government to do something about. The scandal in the Defence Force, as my wife would say, is the paying conditions that so many have suffered for so long. Silently suffered and suffering silently, saying nothing, and still at service to the state, at sterling service to the state. Because there's not one of them out there, and they might laugh and they might skip at this, but it is the truth. There's not one of them out there, Pat, hasn't signed a blank check to the state. Even though the greatest enemy they've ever fought is government, who doesn't care about them.
I want to ask you, and you can tell me as much as you want, but how easy was it for you, with your background in the Defence Forces, to secure much better paid employment?
I wrote a CV on the night I made my decision to go, and 2 weeks later I was in employment.
Good employment, well-paid employment.
Good employment, and I wouldn't mind, but I'm still getting offers. I have my LinkedIn profile there, and I've got people emailing me and messaging me. Snapped up when they see a background as invested in as much with taxpayers' money into me as the Defence Forces put into me. And that's taxpayers' money that the Department of Defence and consecutive governments don't mind spending. You know what I mean? They don't mind spending it because it's not theirs, but it's taxpayers' money. And then I'm going, wait a minute. You're shoveling me into this situation here, and you're paying me a pittance, but you've trained me up to this level, and you're willing to let me go. You know, I is even mentioned there in the Independent article where I said that I messaged Mark Mellett, the chief of staff at the time, and I said it's with great sadness and tears I cut my flashes off my uniform, because I want to have some reminder of my service and what it took to earn every one of those flashes. And he more or less said, "Oh, good luck in your job now." And I just said, the leadership doctrine in the Defence Forces isn't something you beat cadets and NCOs and students on a standard NCOs course. That's people who want to be corporals and sergeants and officers. It isn't something to beat them around the head with. Let's see someone in senior commissioned officer leadership in Defence Forces actually do something. Let's see some leadership. And let's see them politicians then maybe have a read of the leadership doctrine and see what it is to mean leaders eat last.
Finally, I should ask you the reaction of your wife to your decision to leave. Was it one of profound relief?
My wife, Nolan, is an absolute gem. She's one of those women that I could decide to, I don't know, jump and swim the Atlantic and she'd support me. She's a great woman. And when I told her I was leaving, she knew what it meant to me. And I have to say, between being institutionalized, I would say, in the Defence Forces, spending that long in it, and then even though the confidence I had in the Defence Forces and doing what it was and dealing with the weapons, explosives and jumping out of helicopters and what have you, the transition from military to civilian after 21 years was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. And without her support, I probably wouldn't have been there, because I remember one night I came home and I said, with tears in my eyes, I can't do this. I can't transition into this. And she gave me the kick and the proverbial that I needed. And here I am now. And I'm glad I made the transition, but I wouldn't have been able to do it without her.
Well, Mark, I hope that your words are heard in high places. Mind you, they're all probably off on their holliers at the moment. But it's an important message you're giving to government, which is mind the people that you invest so much in and who've invested so much of their own time and their own being in the service of the state. Mark Keeley, former specialist in explosive ordnance disposal. Mark, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.